Today's program is brought to you by Domain. Domain offers discreet and secure storage, transportation, trading, and advisory services to passionate fine wine collectors worldwide. For more information, visit domainstorage.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. I am excited for the show today. We have a true legend, a true master, as a matter of fact, in the studio with us today. We have Larry Stone, Master Sommelier, over 35 years in the wine industry. He's here to talk to us about his new project in Oregon called Lingua Franca. If I were to tell you about all the things Larry's done, all the accolades he's won, best sommelier of French wines in Paris, I could use the rest of the show to tell you about all the great things that he's done in his career. But today we are going to focus on Lingua Franca. One thing I will say to give you a sort of idea as to the kind of career that Larry has had and still has Raj Parr, who's a friend of the show, a friend of mine, arguably, one of the greatest sommeliers in the world, looks at Larry as his true mentor in the wine world. And I think that gives some insight. So, Larry, welcome to In the Drink. It's great to have you here. It's such an honor.
Thank you, Joe. It's really a pleasure to be here.
So about 10 years ago, you really left the restaurant world, is that right? And focused on really on making wine. Tell us about that transition.
Well, I was working, I helped establish Rubicon Restaurant with Druni Porn, and one of the investors was Francis Ford Coppola. So he kept relying on me for advice at that time, and I transitioned into being the gérant, or the general manager of the winery of Rubicon Estate at that time, and now it's Inglenook. He was able to restore the original name. But I'd started making wine as a kid, just playing around with it, and I had studied chemistry, so I was always interested in the winemaking aspect. And when we opened Rubicon, one of the first things I did was get fruit contracts and make a little wine with Daniel Jonas. We had a label called Deux Chapeaux, and that ended a little bit afterwards, and I transitioned that into a little label called Sarita. I named it after my daughter Siri, and that sold pretty well. I made, because I was living in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and Napa Valley was close, I thought the supreme fruit from Northern California is Cabernet from Napa Valley, and I would like to try my hand at that. So I made Cabernet Merlot and Cabernet Franc for a while. And then when I sold that, I tried to figure out what to do with the money. I wanted to buy a vineyard. Vineyards are very expensive in California, and I'm from Washington State, so I looked for a place to do that. So it was always parallel. It was a kind of a parallel thing to my restaurant career, and it was always in the back of my mind to return to hands-on winemaking, which was my love of wine began with cooking and food for my mother, and my father and mother liked wine. They weren't wealthy, so we drank simple things from the Loire Valley, and a lot of crisp white wines from the Loire Valley. We drank a lot of German Riesling I loved the Moselle, especially when I was really, really young. I'm talking about, I started tasting wine when I was 7. And so it was a unique, my father had worked at the Pike Place Market in Seattle, mm-hmm. so in Seattle. Food, wine, chemistry. I liked science. I wanted to know how wine and food were put together, and I studied the chemistry, and that evolved into an interest in chemistry and physics. So,
and I love this idea of you as a teenager trying to make your own wine, not with grapes even, right?
I didn't have grapes because we were too poor to go and get a grape contract. But I thought, well, Riesling tastes like apples, and I like crisp Riesling from the Moselle. So I thought, well, I have to figure out what the chemistry is. Why does it taste that way? And I looked at the acids and the balance of it, and I bought apple juice, and then I acidified it with... I had citric and and some malic, and well, malic was already in the wine, and a little bit of tartaric acid. Mm-hmm. And I studied the, I had a hydrometer, which just really measures the specific gravity. It's a very crude tool to measure the specific gravity. And I adjusted the must to be a specific gravity of a wine that would be about 10% alcohol or 8% alcohol of dry, you know, between 10 and 8. And then I fermented it, and it came out tasting like Riesling. It was
Get
pretty amazing.
Here.
It did. It was actually, I fooled a whole group of professors and graduate students about 10 years later. There was a couple of bottles left at a party, and they tasted it, and they said, I said, it was blind tasting. What is this? And they said it was Mosel Riesling. They said Riesling. They thought maybe Mosel was very crisp, and I was psyched, you know. And then I said, I made it here from apple juice, and they looked at me like, that's, you know, they were incredulous. But none of them ever guessed it was even Washington. I was doing this in Seattle when I was in graduate school, and no one even guessed Washington. And then they finally said, well, it's Washington probably. And I said, no. Well, I said, yes, actually, it's Washington apples. But anyway, that was, I loved that. I loved the idea of how, you know, how do things taste? How do they get put together? Why does food and wine go together? And it was all part of a continuum. It was not to be a career. It was meant to be just a great deal of fun. And then when I was writing my doctoral dissertation, was I actually got actively involved as a sommelier for the first time.
Yeah. I mean, was it that application of chemistry and that kind of practical application of chemistry that got you most interested in wine?
Well, it was the taste. It was all about the taste. You know, when I was a kid, My father worked at the Pike Place Market, so I was at the market. I was looking at fruits and vegetables and fish. And my mother came from a farming family in Romania. She was a great cook, and she you know, and Romania has a good relationship with France, so I learned all these French sauces and pot au choux and everything, you know, cooking and baking had French elements and also Austrian elements where my father's from, so I learned Austrian cuisine very early, and I just loved doing it. I loved, you know, I thought it was great, so it wasn't, that was what interested me in chemistry, and also because my mother would analyze the sauces, and she'd say it's too salty or too acid, and she would fix it, and you go like, well, how do you do that? And she said, well, you know, they balance each other out. And then I was also just curious about everything. And I loved the idea that things were put together with chemicals and molecules and atoms. And so I loved physics and chemistry. And I pursued that. I thought that'd be my career and that I'd be a biochemist. Mm-hmm. And I did start in that career path for like 1 year of my college education, and I did very well in it, but then I wound up doing research very early. I was an honor student, and when I realized I'd be in a lab the rest of my life, I thought that was a little confining and not, and then I reflected and I realized my love of chemistry and science is based also in my love of people and in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, I think I'll pursue until I can figure out how I can put this all together, I'll pursue an interest in poetry and music and history.
Yeah. And I read a story in an interview that you gave for Punch where you spoke about a girlfriend at the time giving you the World Atlas of Wine, a 700-page book, and you memorizing the entire thing.
Well, it was actually Alexis Lachine's Encyclopedia of Wine because the World Atlas wasn't available. It was just coming out, but Alexis Lachine's book was already out. And so I memorized that, and that was the book of the Bible, and I really pretty much memorized it. But good study habits translate into many areas if you're able to sit down and concentrate. And it helped me, of course, when I had my first job interview because I knew everything. And that was the reference book. The guy interviewing me for the sommelier position opened up to grill me with. And I was able to answer all his questions.
And he asked some pretty obscure questions. Here.
Well, the kicker was, you know, the final thing that convinced him I knew more about wine than anyone else, at least that was sort of his words, was that he asked me a question that he looked for one that was so obscure no one could answer, and he said, what is Gumpoldskirchen? And I go, Gumpoldskirchen, it's a town in the Termenregion of Austria near Baden bei Wien. It's used in the casinos there. The grapes are Rotgipfler and Zierfondler mainly, and the guy looks at me, slams the book shut and said, okay, I don't know where you come from, what planet you come from, but you know, I'd hire you if you had restaurant experience. And that was the other thing. As an undergraduate, I worked in a restaurant as a dishwasher, and I didn't put that on my resume. So I had to tell him, you know, I'd worked for 2 years as a dishwasher in the student cafeteria, three sinks, and cleaned the place. And he said, "You're hired." That was it. That was the end of the interview. "You're hired." He said, "You know, the hardest working people in the restaurant industry are dishwashers."
Yeah.
And there are a lot of successful restaurateurs today who started off as dishwashers because they're not afraid of work. It's not a glamorous position by any means.
Yeah, I mean, if you're down a server for a night, or you know, a bartender, someone could jump in. But if you're the dishwashing station is stalled. Yeah. It holds everything up. You can't run the restaurant anymore.
No, it's totally dead. And you know, as we found out when I was working that job, because my employer, for some reason, always was riding me as a dishwasher, and he one day threw all my clean dishes. He said, "I don't like the way they look," and he threw them back in the dirty water. So I had to redo them. They were pretty much done, but it stopped the service for about 45 minutes.
Oh my God.
The cooks were so angry, but it was the owner, you know, they were just angry at him.
When you interviewed sommeliers later on in your career, did you give them the same sort of grilling? Was that kind of minutia of knowing really specific, even obscure pieces of knowledge? Was that important? Was that a way that they were able to prove to you that they had a true like love and interest in wine?
No, I think the most important thing in being a sommelier is your love of helping people and serving them and their needs, not telling them what you know. And unless they ask you questions specifically, and that can actually get in the way sometimes, and they want to know everything at the table. It's like it's not a lecture session. You have other tables to take care of. But you have to know what's appropriate for that person, so you have to listen. I think the most important thing that I looked for and that made my career successful is that I listened to people and found out what they like. So yesterday, a good example of that is a cab driver. I had a box of wine I was carrying around, and he said, "Do you like wine?" I said, "Well, I make wine." And he goes, "Oh, that sounds like an interesting thing. I'm kind of interested in wine now, too, but I don't really know that much. What do you recommend?" And I said, "Well, how do you drink your coffee?" And he goes, "I put 3 cubes of sugar in it." So I'm not going to recommend a Sancerre or a Puy Fumé or a Chablis. I said, "Well, you should try starting with some German Rieslings and try a Spätlese first. And if you think you can go a little drier, try a Cabinet." And I wrote them down, the names down for him, and put them on my card and gave it to him. And I said, "If you have any trouble, just give me a call. I'll figure out where you're going, and I'll call someone and have them expect you." You know, so
wow, that was one lucky cab driver, Larry Stone choosing wines for him.
Yeah, well, you know, you listen. You have to listen to what people like. Not every palate. I think it takes a long time, or it takes a little bit of distancing from what you love to say that person probably won't love it. You know, I grew up with acid wines. Those are the wines my parents drank. They drank, you know, Fouvray and Sancerre and German Rieslings from the Mosel and Chablis, things like that, that were not really very round and friendly. I love those, but I knew when I started my career and people were drinking, you know, things like, Heights, they were the Z-Lot Chardonnays were like the zenith of California Chardonnay. They were beautiful, but they were a little oaky, a little round, you know, a little soft. And then people got into even heavier oaked wines. I wasn't going to recommend to a person like that a Chablis, because it would be beyond their horizon of expectation, so to speak, of what a wine should be for them, and their palate just isn't attuned to that. So you have to ask, you know, do you like it this way, that way? And that's the most important thing. More than any knowledge, you should have the knowledge of listening and understanding to interpret what they're saying to you into what kind of wine they would probably enjoy. And then maybe upping the game, you know, a little bit, giving them a wine that's a little much better than they've ever had in that style, but it's still in a style that they can relate to. It's maybe a bridge to something a little drier, something a little more challenging to them.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, actually, we're going to do a little bridge to a commercial break. And
right.
we'll be right back with Larry Stone, Master Sommelier of Lingua Franca Wines, right after this.
Domain offers discreet and secure storage, transportation, trading, and advisory services to passionate fine wine collectors worldwide. Since 2003, they've focused on making collecting easier and more enjoyable. With over 1.8 million bottles in storage across 5 facilities, Domain is the largest network of wine storage warehouses in the country. Warehouses are located in Chicago, St. Louis, Metro New York, Napa, and Washington, D.C., with refrigerated shipment hubs in dozens of cities. Their service also extends to the home collector. In the last decade, the team has organized and inventoried more than 1.7 million bottles in home cellars across the globe. Additionally, Domain offers auction services to clients with small and large parcels alike, negotiates on their behalf for the best possible price, and manages the entire liquidation process. Go to domainstorage.com to complete an online questionnaire, and someone will get back to you within one business day.
All right, we're back with Larry Stone, Master Sommelier, veteran of the wine industry, has been wine director, general manager of some of the greatest restaurants in America, and has been involved in multiple wine projects, including Sarita, Eveningland Vineyards, and now his very own Lingua Franca. Larry, in the first part of the show, you were mentioning about how you really wanted to buy a vineyard, and you felt like that wasn't possible in California. Why didn't you go the route that so many people go, where they purchase fruit or lease a vineyard? Why do you feel it was so important to own one, and how did you find this one?
You know, it's one of those things that's a mystery. You know, I don't know why as a kid I wanted to make wine. You know, no one else in my family did it. You know, my mother grew up on a farm, and she never said to me my father had a vineyard and made wine. She never told me my grandfather made wine. She talked about the geese and the cows and the wheat and how beautiful the town was that she grew up in. And then it wasn't until after I was in the wine business for like 25 years that she actually said, you know, we also had a vineyard. My father, you know, my father and uncles made some wine. And then a cousin of mine who went back to Romania after the war and lived there, you know, he emigrated since then. But he told me, yeah, I know where the vineyard is. We made wine when we went back after the war. We still had the vineyard. We lost the house and everything, but we had the vineyard. And I go like, oh, that's amazing. No one ever talks about it. And he says, well, you know, we lost most of it, and we just don't really like to talk about the past that much. And the past was very painful for my mother to talk about. Mm-hmm. So it was, I got very little information. So it was amazing. So I don't know why they had a farm. I knew that part. And I think for me to have to grow things and have the whole process in together as one continuous whole, one continuous spectrum of growth from the soil to the vine to the grapes to the juice to the wine, and have that be part of one process was important, to be able to control and have a great sight and control what's going on for good or bad. I mean, it was like something I just wanted to do from a very early age, actually.
And then how did you find this specific site?
Well, I was working at Eveningland, and well, it has a long history as well, because when I was in the late 1980s, I was buying wine and for restaurants, and I bought Oregon wine because I was working in Seattle, and I loved to support the Northwest, and Oregon was great with Pinot, so I bought some Adelsheim Pinot regularly, and some Eyrie and Ponzi, and a lot of great producers that are still around today. Many of them, some aren't, the one thing I really liked when Adelsheim came out with their first year that they had a cuvée that was called Seven Springs, and it's in the old Amity Hills, but I thought maybe they bought this new vineyard, and I called David Ponzi, and David Adelsheim, and I said, congratulations, what a great vineyard, and he said, it's not mine, I just buy the fruit, it's like a really young vineyard, but it seems like very promising, and I said, okay, you know, you make great wine, and I just thought this was really, you know, terrific. I hope you continue. And over the years, when I saw the name Seven Springs come up, I thought it was great. So when I was getting involved in consulting for the Eveningland project with Mark Tarlov, I gave him the sites that I thought were good. I thought he'd take one. He took all of them. I said, you know, Santa Rita Hills. I said Sonoma Coast. And I said, but probably the one with the most promise in my mind would be Oregon and the Willamette Valley, specifically Old Amity Hills, and specifically the hills around Seven Springs. If you can get something near Seven Springs, I'm sure it'll be terrific if it's about the same altitude, the same kind of soil, Jory and Nakaya. And so about 6 months later, he calls me with Dominique Lafon from the vineyard and says, we have a lease. And I go like, what do you mean you have a lease? On Seven Springs. I go like, you got Seven Springs? How did you do that? And I said, did you check it out first? You know, like any problems? Because a lot of vines there can be on own root and phylloxerated and stuff. And he said, no, it's a great deal. We'll get it. So, but he said it's cheaper than an Upper East Side condominium. And I go like, you know, that's not a very good comparison.
No, that really isn't. Yeah.
But anyway, we got it for better or worse, and it's all history because it's made great wine, mm-hmm. And probably even better wine than before. But all our neighbors grow great grapes. The Bjornstads, the BZ, you know, Argyle is right next door, right below Seven Springs, and on the other side, Domaine Serene has a really great vineyard called Jerusalem Hill. So it's a neighborhood. This farm that I bought was sought after for 40 years, and I was just very fortunate to be the one to come to pursue it at the right moment when they were ready to sell it.
And is Dominique working with you on Lingua Franca as well?
He's our consulting winemaker. He's also incredible. He's also vested in the company as well. He's a partner in it. He's a big mentor to our winemaker, who's an extremely talented young man, Thomas Saab. He's amazing. He's inspirational to work with, and I love what he does. And I hope he likes working with me too. I'm sure he's frustrated by me sometimes, but he has made some great wines this first vintage in very difficult circumstances, and the second vintage, which is already in barrel, the 16 vintage is going to even be, I think, better in some ways than the 15. The 15 was great enough, but we had our own equipment, we had our own press, mm-hmm. and I think the quality of the juice, at least coming out, has been really exciting for us.
Yeah. You mentioned that Dominique is invested in this. I know that this must have been an enormous undertaking to raise the money for it. Can you talk about some of your own personal sacrifices that you made in order to make this project happen?
Well, I sold everything I have. I don't have anything left. So if this fails, then I may be knocking on some doors in New York in the future asking for a job, maybe washing dishes, who knows. But in any case, it's a project I feel so strongly, and I truly believe it's the greatest thing I will have done in my life, was to buy this farm and to plant it. Already, whatever happens to our wine company, I feel this is probably the most significant thing I could do, is to take this extremely gifted piece of land and transform it into a vineyard. And I think I did it in a pretty good way. I think I didn't have help from anyone. Dominique wasn't, he was still with Evening Land. I basically studied the clones that I could get, and I wasn't satisfied because of all the disease and all the mix-ups you find in nurseries, and I wanted to source it. I worked with Pépinière Guillaume at that time. It's mm-hmm. a preeminent French nursery that has a small branch in Northern California. And they were willing to source fruit with me from specific vineyard sites so that I knew where it was coming from, not just what clone it was, but who was growing it. So I knew that's the kind of fruit I wanted. So it's more of a Massal selection rather. It's like a cross between Massal and clone, because it's a clone specific to specific vineyards. And then the winemaking team and the people who've come together to help me with this, it's like the greatest thing in my life. People that worked with me as waiters and as bartenders in San Francisco have vested in this. There's a great guy, Mason. He was at Rubicon, and the whole time, from practically the first week to the date we closed, his family is invested in the winery. I've had friends get involved. Michael Koo from Japan, and mm-hmm. Yoshi Takamura is going to import us, and we've had Burgundian winemakers come and want to do things with us. We had the manufacturer of the Tractoran Jambour buy a vineyard site for us so that we could lease it for 32 years, and we have a white wine called Sisters, and now we're going to have that for 32 years. And it's just like it's like almost miraculous. I don't even know how to describe it. It's the greatest thing that's happened to me in my life.
It's a full career of doing great things, making great relationships, and now you get to cash in on all of those things.
Well, I wouldn't say, I'm not cashing in. I have to work still. I have to earn it. But it's so gratifying. When I walk that vineyard, just to walk the vineyard is so exhilarating. And to know that there's promise. It has such a future. It's still nascent. And it's such a beautiful mm-hmm. young thing, and you go, it's going to grow up and be just exciting.
What makes it so special? This is volcanic soil.
It's hard to say why this specific area within the Old Amity Hills. I think it has a combination of things. It's the way the wind comes around there. Mm-hmm. There's the Van Duzer corridor, and we're a little bit off of that. We don't get the direct force of the Van Duzer corridor, so we get gentle breezes. And we can get fairly, gusty days, but it's usually gentle. And so our our phenological development, you know, the evolution of flavors isn't interrupted by stress from dehydration due to wind. We also we're on the east side, so we get the morning sun, and we get the morning sun till, you know, fairly late in the afternoon. So it's more gentle and less hot than if we were on the west side of the hill and got the afternoon sun. So we face the morning. There's the Jorie soils are very common throughout the Willamette Valley. They're the state soil. They're incredible soils. But for whatever reason, between Christom, you know, there was mm-hmm. there's Christom and Woodland Street was there. Antica Terra's on the hill. You have Bethel Heights. You know, that's a great old estate. You've got all this stuff. That the fruit Elton Vineyard, which is one of the older vineyards, is there about a mile and a half from us. We bought fruit from them. Mimi Castile, who's a member of the Castile family that owns Bethel Heights, our best wine. Is from her vineyard. She's now our viticulturalist.
Sorry. Okay, so we've been sipping on your Mimi's Mind Lingua Franca Pinot Noir that is absolutely delicious. This is, you said, your top wine of the estate?
Well, the first wine you had was Ryan's. This is Mimi's.
Okay.
It's a little darker. I still have Ryan's in my glass. You can see it's a little lighter colored.
Yeah.
Mimi's is biodynamically farmed. We're biodynamically farmed now. Mimi has come over to us to help us with all steps of our viticulture, and as well as our we're going to have a farm. We have about 35 acres of land that we want just as a farm. We want to have a kind of a natural environment, so we're going to have fruit trees, nut trees, berries, flowers, all sorts of things. Native, and I think a big thing for Mimi is to restore a lot of the native plants that some of them have been pushed aside by the farming over the last 150 years. Mm-hmm. So. We also have a pond, a wetland pond, and we're going to maintain that for the birds, for the whole year. So we're going to have a whole cycle of life there. Our rodent control is done by hawks and owls. They're pretty efficient.
Incredible. Are all of your wines going to be biodynamic? Is that something that you truly believe in? Or is it going to be?
Well, I think you know, Dominique is very well known for his advocacy biodynamic farming, and we're going to be good big advocates also of that, and it's something that Thomas Saab believes in, and he's worked with biodynamic farming at Domaine de la Romanée-Conti and at Domaine du Jacques, where he staged, he's planted vineyards. He's also does viticulture himself, but he has to focus more on the winemaking. I think he likes selling wine too. Mm-hmm. He's really good at that. He went to Paris. We had little samples of this, and he presented it to Ty Yvonne and the Bristol, and he was very, very successful with that. And there's a gentleman in Eugene that he talked to, and he's bought an enormous amount of wine. A retailer, the Broadway wine merchant, it's called.
Well, I have to compliment you on this project. I mean, the wines are outstanding. I really love them. And I have to admit that Oregon's a place that I haven't paid too much attention to in my career as someone who's focused more on Italian wine.
Yes.
And it's really giving me a reason to pay a lot more attention to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of good producers now. I think there's a whole renaissance there because of a lot of factors. A lot of French companies, a lot of Burgundy estates are looking at Oregon again. Domaine Duran doubled their stake there. They've bought a beautiful property also in Yolamed Hills, Rose Rock. They're making very good wines there. They're going to, I think, you know, they have a long history. They're going to do a great job there. They're making a more refined style or a little lighter style than they did with the Domaine Duran wines. Mm-hmm. And we have Jadot, who's just started, and they're going to grow really well, really strong. Then there are people like Josh Bergstrom who are going to a more refined technique. They're going dialing back the pick days, getting a little lower Brix levels, and trying to make wines. They're reinvigorated by the French model. He went back to France and said Dominique and Cochin, all those guys have inspired him to mm-hmm. change the style slightly starting in 2010. Then there's Walter Scott, Ken Paolo, and Eric Alandon. They are amazing people. Ken worked with me at Eveningland as a salesperson for the Northwest, and he did a great job, but he also had his barrels of wine that Dominique came and tasted through with him and gave him advice on. So Dominique is a big mentor to him, and he's doing a great job. Eric Asimov has written about him, and he's a very small producer and bootstrapped himself. And we're going to do the IPNC this year. We're going to do a dinner together with them. So we're very lucky. It's a great community up in Oregon, as well as being revitalized right now after at this point in its history.
Okay, great. It really sounds like it. And again, big compliments on the Lingua Franca. It's soon to be found at some of the finer restaurants here in New York.
Yeah, and I hope so. Yeah. I think it has already been purchased by a few right now.
Excellent. This has been Larry Stone, Master Sommelier and the founder of Lingua Franca, just absolutely beautiful wines from Oregon. Thank you so much for being a guest on In the Drink.
Thank you, Joe. It's a real pleasure to be here. I love radio.
It was my pleasure as well. And thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.